Reverend Denise Rogers, and this is my lovely daughter, Reverend Danielle Rogers, and welcome to our Martin Luther King celebration. It is sponsored by our organization, which is called the Montana Hate-Free Zone. And I want to begin by thanking our sponsors. I want to thank the Bozeman Daily Chronicle. They are one of our sponsors. I want to thank St. James Episcopal Church, which is one of our sponsors. And most of all, the most incredible sponsors of all of you. Give yourself a round of applause. I think we live in the most incredible city in all of the universe, and I know I'm not alone. We are not only celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King, but we are also celebrating a town called Whitefish, Montana. It's in near the northern part of the state, if you're not familiar with it. 8,000 people. 8,000 people who said no to hate. A neo-Nazi group wanted to come to Whitefish. They wanted to come on Monday and have a parade. They were going to call their parade the James Earl Jones Extravaganza. He is the man that assassinated Dr. Martin Luther King. Not only did they want to do that, they got the names of the members of the Jewish community and wrote letters and threatened them. They even had a picture of a 10-year-old son of one of the Jewish members with a bullseye on it. And through all of that, and the hate rhetoric, and the letters, this group responded with love. They are the heroes in Montana, in my opinion. So we are dedicating this program to Whitefish, Montana. And I encourage all of you, to get on the internet, go to the Whitefish webpage, and send letters of support to their mayor, and he will get them out. But remember Whitefish, because they have said no, and we're following in their footsteps. I'm now going to be turning it over to Reverend Danielle Rogers. Reverend Danielle Rogers is my daughter, and she's on staff at Pilgrim United Church of Christ. So glad everybody's here. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is so wonderful to see your bright, shining faces, especially on such a cold day. I am delighted that we're all here to celebrate the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And we're going to kick off our celebration with a wonderful musical performance from two very dear friends of mine, Megan and Carney. And so I just ask that you please direct your attention to them.
Hi, everybody. I thought that this song would be fitting because it's about coexisting in this world full of lots of different religions, a lot of different skin pigments, but reminding ourselves that we're really not all that different and that we're all human. So we just love each other. This is called The Theme.
Thank you. Megan and Carney. Weren't they wonderful? Let's give another round. We are so blessed to have them as part of our community. And they both do perform around town, so please make sure that you seek them out if you see that they're performing around town. I'm going to announce our next speaker. We have some really wonderful speakers for you today. And I'm going to introduce Father Greg Smith. He is an Episcopalian priest at St. James, and he's also a human rights activist. He's going to come and share some thoughts with us today, so please extend an invitation to Father Greg Smith.
Thank you. Like, it's a big mistake to give a preacher a microphone. Love lives here. What does that mean? Love lives here. We can talk about what it means to be alive. We can talk about what it means to live. We can talk about what it means to exist versus thrive. We can talk about all sorts of different ways that we're supposed to live out love, right? But in the end, we kind of get confronted with our own humanity. Life is hard, said Scott Peck in his book, The Road Less Traveled. I don't know if you've ever read it. It's true, isn't it? Life can be very difficult. With even the ordinary burdens of human life, it's difficult to negotiate this existence. Now, imagine adding on other challenges. Maybe a disability. Maybe low economic advantages. Maybe heavy medical bills. Maybe racial prejudice and bias. Maybe add on issues of sexuality and gender identity and expression. Heck, add on gender, too. Add on situation, location, lack of housing, lack of access to hygiene resources, mental illness, physical illness, religious belief, political affiliation. Add on just one of those things to an ordinarily difficult life, and it can be most difficult indeed. I was asked to reflect a little bit on a particular subject that's very dear to my heart, and that was the murder of Matthew Shepard in Laramie, Wyoming. When news of Matt Shepard's murder reached me, it shook me to my core. Maybe it did you too. That kid and I had a lot in common. Both grew up in rural areas, both smart enough, precocious, friendly. And above all, I remember being 21 years old and having that desperate need to be loved. Maybe you do too. And to have that poor kid murdered by people who were afraid of him or who just needed to feel powerful, we'll never know. It was just too close for me somehow to ever feel completely safe in this world ever again. I still hesitate before I grab my husband's hand or show affection in public. I still try to not be too gay in public, although I'm pretty gay. But I want you to understand the terror that gripped my heart and that grips the hearts of countless people around me. People hate us, is what I remember feeling viscerally. People hate me without ever knowing who I am. They just know what I am, and they don't like it. They hate me because of something beyond my or any other human being's control. It has to be said that in the years following Matt's death that the world is much changed, but it still regularly inflicts terror upon its LGBTQ citizens. Religion, politics, institutions all regularly take advantage of their power to harm, And I'm here to say today, it must stop. As someone who spent more than 25 years in pastoral ministry with other human beings, I work every day to live out and show by example the message of Jesus, who loved instead of hated, who was someone who gave in to the power of love, not the love of power. And I think sometimes all we need is to realize that we have some power in being loving beings. We have very much power in being loving beings. But there are those out there who are afraid, who are ignorant, uneducated, living in a bubble that may be just too small for them in this world. And I want to be able to stand up to them and say, there's nothing to be afraid of. Do you know in the Bible how many times it says, be not afraid, or don't be afraid, or fear not? 365 times, one for every day of our year. And I think that's fundamental to us people of faith. I can't be afraid, but I'm also not always feeling safe. I don't know about you. There were a couple things I was going to say, and I changed my mind. Mostly because I was going to be critical of people, and that's not what this is about. I want us to be for something, not against something. We are for love. We're not against hate. Mm-hmm. If we spend so much time looking at how loving we can be, there won't be any room for hate. And I'm a firm believer in acknowledging the kind, the good, and the beneficial, and that helps to erase the painful, the hateful, the mean, the angry. It just does. Once Mother Teresa was asked to march against the Vietnam War, and she said no. She said, I don't want to march against anything. But if you have a march for peace, I'll be right there with you. I just want to invite us all to express and to involve ourselves in working for that love, that peace. We're not working against anything. They're working against us. Uh-huh. And they're wrong. Yes. I'd like to read something from this book called Losing Matt Shepherd. And just to tie this all in today, the author says, I didn't know Matthew Shepherd. I couldn't tell you what his hobbies were or how tall he was. But I can honestly say that I have grieved over his death as though he were my friend. I was not aware of the fact that Matthew was an activist of sorts, that he was a humanist, and wanted to make life better for people. All I could think is that he is dead and I'm alive. And that means I have work to do. Amen.
Thank you very much, Father Greg. That was really poignant. I'm now going to introduce our next speaker. Our next speaker is Dr. Frankie Wilmer. Many of you may know Frankie as a state legislator and a professor of international relations at MSU. You may not know that both her life and scholarly work has long been inspired by Dr. King and other advocates of the nonviolent resistance. Going back to high school in 1968, Frankie helped organize a biracial group of students to challenge segregation of a local teen center and the restaurant owned by the then mayor of her hometown in West Virginia. In addition to participating in the anti-war and pro-civil rights protests in her early college career, and after receiving her PhD and coming to MSU, Frankie was again organizing. This time, three carloads of American Indian students and supporters to travel to San Francisco and to protest
The Quintincentenary of Columbus Day in October 1992. While doing her research in Bosnia and the former Yugoslavia during the 1990s wars there, Frankie also stood with the Women in Black in Belgrade, Serbia, protesting the war and human rights violations in Milosevic. And this summer, as she started work with peace groups in Israel and Palestine, she walked with the Combatants for Peace protesters in Beit Jalal and Jerusalem, and went with David Shulman's Ta'ayush activists to defend Palestinian goat herders from harassment in the area of Susia, Palestine. Today, Frankie will reflect on Dr. King's legacy of nonviolent anti-war, pro-peace activism, and thinking. Dr. Frankie Wallace.
How's this sound? Because I can't tell. All right. So I'm going to stick to my notes. My students know, otherwise I would wander off a little bit too much. And as for the introduction, yes, I am that old. I've been at this a long time. Well, preachers are going to preach, and I have to say I'm much happier to follow Father Greg, no offense, than Reverend Case, which I have followed many times. The year I graduated from high school, the year I looked out into the world and wondered where and how I would make my place as an adult in that world, was the year two Americans who had enormous influence on shaping my vision of the good society were assassinated. The first was the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., At his funeral in April of that year, 1968, Robert Kennedy gave what is still, in my view, probably the greatest speech of his life, known today as On the Mindless Menace of Violence. Then 2 months and one day later, he was also gunned down in a hotel in Los Angeles and died the next day. Decrying the disutility of violence, Senator Kennedy said, "There is another kind of violence that's slower, but just as deadly, destructive as the shot or the bomb in the night. This is the violence of institutions, indifference, and inaction and slow decay. This is the violence that afflicts the poor, that poisons relations between men because their skin has different colors. This is the slow destruction of a child by hunger, and schools without books, and homes without heat in the winter. This is the breaking of a man's spirit, denying him the chance to stand as a father and as a man among other men. And this, too, afflicts us all." In his conclusion, he said, and I was unable to do this without crying last night, so let's see. "Our lives on this planet are too short and the work to be done too great to let this spirit flourish any longer in our land. Of course, we cannot banish it with a program or a resolution. But perhaps we can remember, even only for a time, that those who live with us are our brothers, and that they share with us the same short movement of life, that they seek as we do nothing but the chance to live out their lives in purpose and happiness, winning what satisfaction and fulfillment they can. Surely this bond of common faith, this bond of common goal, can begin to teach us something. Surely we can learn at least to look at those around us as fellow human beings, and surely we can begin to work a little harder to bind up the wounds among us and become, in our hearts, brothers and countrymen once again. There's not one war I've studied and not one war zone or zone of conflict I've been in, not one battleground for justice where this is not the underlying cause, the deprivation of basic rights. Those rights necessary for all of us to live our lives in purpose and happiness. We are here to commemorate the legacy of Dr. King, and I to talk about his commitment to nonviolent resistance, to injustice, domination, and deprivation. I think these two words are crucial to remember, nonviolence and resistance. I'll be a little more edgy than maybe you were. But no less loving. Well, maybe because I can't speak to the same level. Dr. King became a leader in the movement to end institutionalized and normalized racism, the civil rights movement, at a time when on the one side there were organizations committed to change through the normal and non-confrontational channels. of politics, lobbying, and the courts. Chief among them was the NAACP. And on the other hand was Frantz Fanon, psychiatrist turned Algerian revolutionary from Martinique, and the Black Power movement inspired by him. On this side, in contrast to the normal politics and legal channels used by the NAACP, organizations inspired by Fanon held that no group with power and the privilege that goes with it ever give it up peacefully. King debated with both of these sides, though mostly against Black Power and Fanon. In his book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community, Dr. King wrote, "The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Through violence, you may murder the liar, but you cannot murder the lie, nor establish the truth. Through violence, you may murder the hater, but you do not murder the hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate." Things seemed easier back then in the 1960s. I mean, the wrongs were easier to see as wrong. I grew up with segregation, with whites-only water fountains, and crosses burned in the front yards of Black residents, would-be voters. Where did I grow up? Alabama, you might think, or Mississippi. No, I was born in Washington, D.C., and we lived at that time in Northern Virginia. Another individual known for his involvement with civil rights also lived in Northern Virginia and died there. In fact, he was also assassinated just a little more than 7 months before Dr. King. He led counter demonstrations to Dr. King's. He led demonstrations against the freedom fighters and against the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. He was a Holocaust denier, and he believed that integration was a Jewish conspiracy to enable Jews and African Americans to, quote, rule over the Black community. His name was George Lincoln Rockwell, and he was the founder of the American Nazi Party. He was killed leaving a laundromat in Arlington, Virginia, where he lived and where the party had its headquarters. This only proves Dr. King's point. Neither did Dr. King's murder end the quest for economic and racial justice and freedom, nor did Rockwell's murder put an end to the evil of white supremacy. Both are with us today. The hate and ill intentions of white supremacists who advocated hate against my friends in Whitefish is an obvious wrong. I refuse to give them further airtime, but suffice it to say that their rhetoric is vile. But most of the injustices perpetrated by institutions and social practices that oppress today are more difficult to discern. What we called police brutality in the 1970s, and which then and now has overt links to racism, is alive and well today in the disproportionate use of lethal force by law enforcement when a suspect is Black. People seem confused at this time because we've had three Black presidential candidates. One of them won twice. We've had a Black woman Secretary of State. We have a Black brain surgeon about to be confirmed as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. But how many times have you had to explain why Black Lives Matter does not mean that non-Black lives don't matter? The problems are more complicated today, but they have the same roots. Dr. King knew that justice and peace were inseparable, and he said so many times and very eloquently. I think what we really need to stand up to, and what we need to change, is the politics of fear, domination, and control. And everything I've read that Dr. King wrote, said, and thought tells me that he would agree. The politics of fear, domination, and control rationalize violence and lead us falsely to believe that it's inevitable or even necessary. Now, I want to say that military intervention to stop an ongoing genocide or humanitarian crisis is the only kind of violence I can think of that clearly rests on solid moral ground. When have we ever actually done that? Not in the Holocaust, not in Cambodia, and not in Rwanda. We agree or we lament that someone should do something, but we don't do anything. I don't have the time right now to go into why we lack the political will to engage in what are called humanitarian interventions. You can take my class. Or I'm teaching this semester the politics of war and peace. But those interventions are driven not by fear, domination, and control, but motivated instead by care and empathy for the suffering of others and a resolve to intervene to stop it. Returning to the problem of politics that rely on fear, domination, and control, this is what must be opposed and resisted. Recognize the language of fear, domination, and control. So much preventable human suffering would be prevented if we just were clear about that. Any action, any policy, any institution that plays on fear, tells you that domination is the answer or control is the answer, perpetuates immoral violence. Dr. King resisted all three. His life was a site of resistance. With every breath, he opposed destructive emotions and called on us to regard empathy as a civic virtue. Walking in the shoes of a fellow citizen should not diminish our opportunities to be fully human and to live with purpose and happiness. Dr. King offered hope instead of fear, justice instead of domination, and freedom instead of control. Fear, domination, and control are the enemies of democracy and the enemies of peace. They produce and rely on hierarchies of superiority and inferiority of race, class, gender, ethnicity, sexual identity, gender identity. The reason Dr. King and others regard peace and justice as inseparable is that peace without justice is only peace for some at the expense of others. In the same way, freedom without justice is not freedom. Freedom for some is not just, and therefore it's not freedom, it's privilege. Well, those are some of my thoughts about the lessons Dr. King has for us today. I'd like to close with a story from that book, Chaos or Community. Parts of that book are also to be found in his acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize. He calls the last chapter The World House. He tells of a novelist who, following his death, left behind more ideas for stories. I think a novelist should always die with more stories than they've written. Right? Mm-hmm. And he notes one in particular. This is a quote from his book. A widely separated family inherits a house in which they have to live together. This is the great new problem of mankind. We have inherited a large house, a great world house in which we have to live together. Black and white, Easterner and Westerner, Gentile and Jew, Catholic and Protestant, Muslim and Hindu. A family unduly separated in ideas, culture, and interests, who, because we can never again live apart, must learn to live somehow with each other in peace. However deeply American Negroes are caught in the struggle to be at last at home in our homeland in the United States, we cannot ignore the larger world house in which we are also dwellers. Equality with whites here will not solve the problems of either whites or Negroes if it means equality in a world society stricken by poverty and in a universe doomed to extinction by war. Violence, he says, often brings about momentary results. Nations have frequently won their independence in battle. But in spite of temporary victories, violence never brings permanent peace. It solves no social problem. It merely creates new and more complicated ones. It is immoral because it seeks to humiliate the opponent rather than win his understanding. It is immoral because it thrives on hatred rather than love. It destroys community and makes brotherhood impossible. It leaves society in monologue instead of dialogue. Violence ends up defeating itself. It creates bitterness in the survivors and brutality in the destroyers. And so I close with his words from the same book, Returning Violence for Violence Multiplies Violence. Thank you. Thank you.
people that we're going to hear from are very special to me. They are my family. This is Reverend Danielle Rogers. She is an ordained minister. She is my world. She is my life. She is my mentor. She's the one I turn to. She is on staff at Pilgrim United Church of Christ. She is a graduate of American University, where she received a degree in journalism. She then went on to seminary, Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, where she received her master's in theological studies. She is an actress, singer, dancer, and the co-founder of our organization, the Montana Hate-Free Zone. The young man sitting next to her is my heart. He's my conscience. He's the one that I get to play with. His name is Tom Frank, and he is Danielle's husband. But he is more than that. He graduated from Montana State University. He has a background in the creative arts. He is an inventor, visual artist, writer, and a rancher. Ladies and gentlemen, we will be debuting a play that I wrote, and it is called Riding the Bus in the Summer of 1964. Please enjoy.
The play takes place in Washington, D.C. during the summer of 1964. College students from various colleges are preparing to go south to register African Americans so they can vote. The play takes place on one of the chartered buses.
Excuse me, is this seat taken?
No, it's not taken. You can sit here.
Thanks. Actually, I think I'm on the wrong bus. I don't see any of my friends on this bus. My name is William. What is your name?
Oh, my name's Brenda. I don't see any of my friends either. Now, I got here late, so I just got on this bus. I figured I'd find them at the student headquarters in Selma. I attend Howard University. What college do you attend?
I go to American University. I'm a second-year law student. I am focusing on civil rights law. That is why I'm going to Selma, to help people to register to vote. I can't believe that it is 1964 and black people can't vote like everyone else.
When I heard black people had to guess how many jelly beans were in a jar, or they had to walk 50 miles in order to vote, I knew I had to go down there to help.
Finally, we're leaving. I have to admit, I'm a little bit scared. I have never been to the South before, and that training we had to take prepare us for this trip caught me off guard. I mean, when the trainer showed us how to cover our vital organs when they knock us down and kick us, that was way too over the top for me. I mean, we are Americans. It's against the law to treat us like that.
Well, I wasn't afraid until our trainer said that the black students should be very careful because the Klan kidnap us and lynch us. You know, I heard from my grandmother that lives in Alabama that there were a couple of black folks and they went missing. They did find two black men hanging from trees last week. My grandmother said they hadn't gotten paid in 3 weeks, and they just asked when they were going to get paid, and then they disappeared. The following week, they found them dead, hanging from two trees. They were beaten up pretty bad also.
That is terrible. I mean, who could do such a horrible thing? I heard in one of my law classes there is this young Baptist minister by the name of Martin Luther King, and he is starting to organize black people to stand up for their rights. Have you heard anything about him?
I only know what my grandmother told me. She really likes him. She said he's young, he's willing to stand up to the race of sheriff and the Klan. You know, he's what black people really need. We need a strong leader. Oh, it looks like there's only a half an hour left and we'll be there. And I really feel like we're going to do some good for the people.
I hope we will be working together. looks like we're here.
Yep, we're here. Well, it was nice talking to you, William. Freedom, summer 1964. South saw thousands of college students from the north going south to win freedom for black people. These students were black, white, Jewish, and Asian. Several lost their lives at the hands of the Klan. Many had dogs attack them and bite them. Many were put into jail, but refused to ask for bail so the money could be used to further the civil rights movement. Over 80,000 black people were registered to vote that summer. Thanks to the work of these dedicated young people, President Johnson instituted the Voting Rights Bill that allowed black people the right to vote. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. worked tirelessly to force President Johnson to sign the bill. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dan Lurie. He's a lifetime activist for peace and justice. He's a veteran of civil rights and anti-war movements since the 1960s. He worked to integrate Houston schools in the late 60s and early 70s. He attended Texas Southern University Law School. He's a liaison to Houston African American community in statewide elections. He's a peacekeeper. He's a speaker at anti-war rallies and marches. So please, I introduce to you, Dan Lurie.
I know that I swore 2 or 3 years ago to never speak after Frankie Wilmer. It appears that I now have other names to add to that list. We all have Martin Luther King-related memories, from books, a lifetime of public events, and our own memories of the movement in our younger years. We often speak with reverence and awe about his wisdom, eloquence, courage, and achievements, but sometimes forget his determined actions for and appreciation of the children and young people who joined so heroically and enthusiastically in the movement and the struggles for equality. History records the participation and eventual impact of many young people on the march towards desegregation and equality. At its height in the 1960s, the civil rights movement drew children, teenagers, and young adults into meetings, marches, violence, and in some cases, imprisonment. Thousands of students, for example, left school and marched on downtown Birmingham, Alabama. An 18-year-old led 800 students from their all-black high school, walking 10 miles to Birmingham, where they were arrested and jailed. By then, 3,000 black young people were marching on the city and were met with attack dogs and fire hoses. Pictures of their bravery and determination in facing such brutality were on the front pages of the world's newspapers, turning public opinion in support of the fight for justice and equality. This was Dr. King's 1963 Children's Crusade, a pivotal action in the fight for equality for African Americans. Many activists have been in elementary school, had been in elementary school when joining the movement, and even after the attacks by dogs and hoses, were arrested and spent many days in prison. Dr. King told the children in the prison, what you do this day will have an impact on children yet unborn. How much more powerful a statement could he have possibly made to these children? When I talk with young people about Dr. King's view of their role in the achievement of justice, equal rights, civil rights, I try to echo his message that young people can be part of the process, not just watching events go by. I tell them that when they decide what it is they consider to be their dream of justice, their version of a moral society, their understanding of progress towards true equality for all, they should remember that there are precedents for them to follow. That Dr. King taught that they are not too young to speak with passion and to stand up for their principles. That no man, as Dr. King said in Birmingham, can ride their backs unless they are bent. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Our next speaker is the Reverend Denise Rogers. She is the founder and director of the Montana Hate-Free Zone. She also does Native American campus ministry. She received her Master's of Divinity from Princeton Seminary and is a recipient of many humanitarian awards, including the Woman of Courage Award. She is also my mother. Reverend Denise Rogers.
Couldn't imagine who could this be without their parents. And as she got closer, she realized it was her son. She almost didn't recognize him. He was beaten. His eyes were swollen. He was limping, but he was alive. She hugged her son and said, "Where have you been?" And he said, "Mom, I didn't listen and the Claire got me. And they took me to this cave. And they beat me. And Mom, inside that cave, there were skeletons. Lots and lots of skeletons. And I knew they were black people that had been missing. And I thought I was going to be like them, Mom. And I guess I passed out because when I woke up, they were gone. I left the cave as soon as I could, Mom." He said, "Do you know where the cave is?" And he said, "Yes." That little boy had to endure something that no human being should ever have to endure. The story that I have just shared is a true story. The story I have shared is the story of one of my ancestors. The mother's name was Carol Rogers, and her son William was the little boy who escaped that cave and lived to tell this story. So when I, at 64 years of age, say that I am done with hatred, when I say I am done with the Ku Klux Klan, when I say I am done with neo-Nazis, when I say I am done with any form of hatred, I speak from experience and I speak from my family. Their voices from the grave. We must love. We must accept one another. My color is brown. It's just melanin. That's all it is. It won't hurt anybody. And that's the message we have got to get out to the world. I chose to dedicate this program to the community of Whitefish because when I read what was going on, when I read how one man named Richard Spencer got upset because he thought his mother was being persecuted, that he called another friend who decided to call some more friends who happened to be neo-Nazis and told them to come to Whitefish and march down the street with guns, I knew we had to respond. This is Montana. You have to be special to live in this state. Just dealing with the weather alone. Just trying to drive down the street in ice and snow. Trying to live on $11 an hour. Trying to find housing. You have to be special, and we are. We are the most incredible people in the United States. I'm not ashamed to say that. I don't care if you were born here or if you moved here. You are now a Montana. And when someone comes to our state to bring hate, we must say no. And when someone comes to our state and attacks a town in our state, we must say no. People laugh at us in Montana because they think we don't have electricity. They think we're not that smart. They think we don't have modern conveniences. And you know what? We don't correct them. Because we don't want them to come. We want our state. human rights organization and Whitefish. They came together to say no to hate. They did not come together to say, let us hate Richard Spencer. Let us hate the neo-Nazis. They came together to say, love lives here. And we in Bozeman will also say, love lives here too. I am so proud to say that love is the greatest healer of all. Hate comes from fear. Fear that somebody else might have something you don't have. Fear that somebody else is going to take away something that you need. Fear that they're going to get ahead of you. But love lets you know that we are all the same. Love lives here. The Montana Hate Free Zone began in 1993 when the Klan came here and they went to Vargo's bookstore. Francis, the owner, had pictures of jazz musicians in the window. And the Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan didn't like it because the musicians were black. And they threatened his life. Then they went around Bozeman putting flyers on cars saying that the Klan was here and that black people should be killed and murdered, thinking we would be afraid. Boy, did they pick the wrong town. They picked the wrong town. Mike Jordan and I started the Montana Hate Free Zone, and I will be honest, I had just moved here from the East Coast. I did not know how this community would react. And we came together as a community. We said no to hate, yes to love. The Bozeman Chronicle, who I love, made a point of keeping our stories in the paper, publicizing what was going on. And they are one of our sponsors today. Love lived in Bozeman in 1993. Our city commission proclaimed a proclamation that Bozeman was a hate-free zone. I went to the then governor, Mark Roscoe, and I asked that the entire state become a hate-free zone. You know what happened? The Ku Klux Klan, the militia, and the Aryan Nation said that I had no right to ask that our state be declared a hate-free zone. They said it was their American right to hate. And they were afraid that I was going to ask the state legislatures to pass a law proclaiming Montana a hate-free zone. I got death threats because I wanted to declare Montana a hate-free zone. Well, guess what? I, too, have freedom of speech. I declare Montana a hate-free zone.
poetry. Love lives here too. Some of you have never experienced love. Some of you grew up in households where you were beaten, neglected. I did. My mother committed suicide when I was 7 years old. My father was a batterer. He was also mentally ill. He beat my mother. My mother had no recourse, or so she thought. She jumped into Lake Erie at the age of 28. I was 7 years old and left with a monster, my father. Every day I was told how ugly I was, how fat I was, how stupid I was, and how he hated me, and how he wished I would run away. Every day I was beat down with words of hate. I very seldom held my head high. My brother endured the same abuse, and at the age of 23, he too jumped into Lake Erie and killed himself. My uncle, when I was 12, had a nervous breakdown and ended up in a mental institution. From years of being told he was stupid, they couldn't hire him because of the color of his skin, and he too committed suicide. Hate and ignorance kills people. If you have never been told that you are worthy, if you have never been told you are accepted, if you have never been told you are loved, you don't know how to share it with other people. I love Richard Spencer. I love the neo-Nazis. I love the Ku Klux Klan. I love President-elect Donald Trump. I love those who would hate me, because my faith, my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, caused me to. And you know what happens? It makes me one of the most powerful women on the planet, because I do not allow hate to take over. Love lives here in Bozeman. Love lives here in Montana. And I need your help. I need your compassion. I need your wisdom. I need your money. I need your ideas. I need everything that you have that is good. And I need it so that we can kick the Montana hate-free zone up to another level. I am creating, along with these wonderful speakers, and I have not shared this with them, I am sharing with them my idea that we are going to have a peace institute here in Bozeman. And all of our speakers and musicians will be a part of that Peace Institute. We know how to hate, don't we? We know how to say, I don't like you. We know how to say, oh, they shouldn't come in here. We know how to say, oh, if only they. But we don't know how to say, I love you. We don't know how to say, you don't have to hit your wife. We don't know how to say, you're not a bad person. We don't know how to say, you are we are going to know how to do those things. Love lives here too. And I need you. We all need you. Now I want to take a couple of minutes, because I am a minister, and I want you to turn to the person to your left and say, I love you.
So we're all going to
die. I want you to turn to the person to your right and say, I love you. I want you to turn to the person to your left.
I need to get this back to people.
Turn to the person to your left and say, you look good today.
It all for me, because I got nobody.
Do I get a hug?
Yeah, I do.
how bad was that when they did, right? Bad was over.
Gandhi's the same way. What he said, what he did, his actions. Martin Luther King, man of God first and foremost, what he said, what he did, that's where we have to look, what we really do, the actions. You know this one.
Let's